A 475 Wildey Magnum is a shorter version of the African Big Game cartridge. It makes a real mess. We're talking Death Wish 3. Hit it. It was 1985. Foreigner wanted to know what love is. The Goonies was released. Thundercats debuted, and Paul Kersey was let loose back in New York City. I'm your host, Jerry D, with another episode of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, and fads. If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, we got it covered. Now, before I introduce my guests, it's time for the 80s word of the day. As always, it comes from the Dictionary of 1980 Slang by Rick Carlisle. Today's word is jacked. Adjective, intoxicated, high, excited, crazy, hyper, also jacked up. You sell to the kids, you get them good and jacked up for 3 hours so that by 10 o'clock they're ripping the house apart, from Big, 1988. Use it all the time. Now joining me is a totally rad Christmas all-star and ratty winner and two brand new guests. From the Filmstrip podcast, it's Ron, Jay, and Lindsay. Guys, what's happening?
Jerry, it is wonderful to be back here on Totally Rad Christmas, and it's even better to have my podcast partners, Jay and Lindsay, right alongside us.
Absolutely. Jerry, glad to be on this side of the fence this time. We had you on Gremlins last year, so fun to come over here on Totally Rad Christmas. Thanks for having us.
Likewise.
Yeah, I'm excited for this one. This is like one of those guilty pleasures of mine, this particular film here. It's not a whole lot of Christmas, but I've gone on far less. So I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. But, you know, before we like really dive into the whole thing, you know, just what's your like general history? What do you remember about Death Wish as a franchise and this particular movie, you know, specifically?
I can specifically say I saw this one first out of all of them because it was on whatever cable thing we had going, you know, it was one free weekend or whatever. And I just
Showtime,
remember
probably
so. Yeah. And probably. I remember the advertisement because it was all about Bronson with that huge gun. And then I remember walking through the mom and pop video stores and him holding that thing. And I think at that point I had probably seen like Sudden Impact or something. So I knew of the 44 Automag, the Dirty Harry stuff. And so I thought, is that the same thing? And years later, I found out, no, it's not. And, but yeah, I saw this one first and then I probably went to a college to actually watch like actual Death Wish and Death Wish 2. And I've seen all of them at least once, but I will say I've seen this one the most out of all of them now, cause I watched it twice for this review. So I've seen it three times in my life.
Right on. What about you, Lindsay?
I also saw Death Wish 3 first. I watched it for the first time today, actually.
So oh, okay.
This is very fresh in my mind.
Nice.
I have plenty of other movies from 1985 that I've watched 8 million times, The Goonies included.
Right.
But yeah, this was my first Death Wish 3 experience.
Lindsay, you got to tell them how you watched it too, because that was half of a hilarious texture yeah. We had going today.
Yeah. I watched it while I was at work on my lunch break, and we have a summer intern right now, and I have three screens at my desk, and I had it on my smallest screen just to be discreet. But the intern came up to ask me a question, and he goes, "Are you watching a movie?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Are we allowed to do that?" And I was like, "Just mind your business."
Like, no.
I said, doesn't matter.
That's I think a step up from how I saw it, which was just on my phone, like as I was getting ready for work and just anytime I could during the day. So on a small screen, I think I'd take it over my phone anytime. What about you, Ron?
I saw this one first as well because of Showtime. It's the one I've seen the most I've seen it, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10 times before watching it for the podcast. So I'm pretty familiar with it. But yeah, I also watched it at work on my phone. So I kind of split the difference between you and Lindsay.
Am I the only person that watched this on actual television? I watched this on Tubi.
I watched it on Tubi also.
We all watched it on Tubi, just through different sources.
Right. Wow. You gotta love Tubi. They have like all sorts of crazy, insane, but awesome stuff there.
Tubi just needs to rename itself like Action Collection Yard or Junkyard or something like that.
They need to rename it like Junkyard. Like Hot Garbage TV. Yes. It's exactly what you want.
A lot of it
exactly. Yeah.
Speaking yes. of cool 80s Christmas TV. Movies like Trancers, which is also Trancers, I watched most yeah, recently
covered,
on Tubi.
Covered that one. Yeah, that's a good one too.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that in a long time.
And it, and it's
I a, hadn't whatever. Seen it in a long time either. Yeah, I remember seeing it like back in the 80s and then slipped my mind. And then all of a sudden, you know, someone brought it up. I was like, I got to do that one. And so I covered that with the Cult Film Club guys. And man, that movie holds up.
Funny thing, I used to get that and Scanners like confused with each other for years. And later on, I sort of corrected the Cronenberg education to get that right. But I was like, oh, yeah, that's not the same thing. But for a long time, I just convinced it was the same bit. But I think there were like 8 or 9 Trancers, right? Or something like that.
I think there's 6.
There's 6.
I knew there were at least 6. I think so, yeah. Okay. That's a lot.
And I've seen at least 4 of them. So
that's a lot of Trancers, nice. Y'all.
Yeah.
I've only seen Trancers and then Trancers, I guess, 1.5, I think it's called, or something like that. But
I'm not familiar with Trancers 1.5. I've seen 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I've probably also seen 6. I don't know if I've seen 5.
Right on.
Because 6 doesn't have Tim Thomerson. They replace him with Jack Death's like past daughter.
So when you say okay. Tim Thomerson, 2 things immediately pop in my head. 1, Kel Barnett from Rhinestone, which is not a Christmas movie, but it's definitely 80s scary. So we're gonna have to do that at some point.
I'm down.
My love for Dolly Parton knows no end. And I will stand for Sly just about on anything, even when he's terrible. And he is in that movie. And I think of him as Colonel Masters in Iron Eagle. He's Doug's dad. Yeah. He's the inciting incident of Iron Eagle. So yeah.
See, I remembered him from Who's Harry Crumb? Like he was she has an affair with him or something, like her tennis instructor or something like that. That's like how I knew him. But I think he's also in Cherry 2000.
He is, which is a movie I need to revisit.
It's a good one. Yeah, I saw it. I was on vacation for like 6 weeks, so I got to watch like just a ton of crappy and awesome movies as well. So, yeah, that was a good one.
So your Tubi library is huge.
It's huge. Yeah, yeah. There's all sorts. Like it spans. But Charles Bronson is also a lot on Tubi, this one in particular. For me, I actually saw Death Wish 4 first, and I'll never forget it. I was over at a friend's house, and his parents rented it, and they're like, hey, you want to watch this with us? They're like, yeah, okay. And it was awesome. So from there, I actually went back and saw like 1. I don't think I've ever seen 2, but I saw 3 and then 4 and 5. So I have like, I think I've seen 1 the most out of all of them, but this one is one that I'll pop on like, I don't know, maybe once every couple of years and just sit back and enjoy the Charles Bronson of it all. Because you're right, like that gun, like I remember that gun on all the VHS covers. That was like the big selling point. And it was like so awesome to just a kid in the 80s. Like, wow, this is the coolest thing ever. So, I remember just putting it on and just enjoying that cool, you know, basically rifle in a handgun.
Yeah, Charles, I think I got introduced to Bronson in The Dirty Dozen.
That
was probably the first thing I saw him in, and because my dad was a big fan of that movie, so I watched that when I was younger. And he just made such an impression because I knew he was in like these kind of action movies. I saw the poster art everywhere, and so on the box art rather on VHS cassettes. Kids back when you rented movies that way, back before Netflix ruined the surface image of anything. So, but I I remember seeing him and stuff, and then seeing him later to do this kind of stuff. And it's just funny, you know, to watch him sort of walk through it. The thing that blew me away about this, and I didn't realize he was 64 when he made this movie. And he's been gone for a long time, but I was like, holy cow, he was definitely there. And then when I realized his co-star was literally half his age in this movie, I was like, well, okay, welcome to the 1980s and Golden Globus cocaine productions. So
it's not Golden Globus without cocaine.
It's like Don Simpson without cocaine, you know? So. That's
right. That thing's not possible, Jay.
Yeah. Yeah, this doesn't work, man.
Agreed.
Yeah. And I remember Charles Bronson from, of course, The Magnificent Seven. You know, that's like was my first introduction to him, but also from like a more obscure movie from like 75, 76 ish called Breakheart Pass. I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah. I remember that one. Yeah. Again,
it's like a train robbery.
Westerns, yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah. I think it was, I probably saw it on like a TBS or something.
It was something like that. Yeah. I that's how I saw it too. And I just like, I was like, hey, it's that guy from The Magnificent Seven, you know, the one that dies.
When I was a kid, TBS was a rotation of either really bad Braves baseball, obscure Westerns, or NWA wrestling. That was pretty much all they had. So, and I loved all of that, by the way, just for the record.
Okay, I was wondering, you say, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Oh, I will stand for old school NWA, early WCW, pre Bischoff any day. So, or that cartoon WWF garbage.
All right, Jerry, that just settles it for when we do the wrestling show part two. Jay needs to come on.
Jay needs to be on there too. All right,
I need somebody else on the show who remembers like Terry Funk pile driving Ric Flair through the table
and
all that stuff.
Somewhere in a box in my storage, I'm not making this up, I have like a PW Insider magazine that's all about that. Because I saw that happen. And I thought, because a friend of mine had the pay-per-view and VHS taped it. And he brought it over to my house the next day. He's like, dude, you gotta watch this. Like, we were watching because he knew I was a big Ricky Steamboat fan. And so, as to digress here, but yeah, when Terry Funk pile drives Ric Flair through the table and literally breaks his neck, like that was an actual thing. I'm like, oh, I screwed that storyline up for about 8 months. So, but man, they stretched that out forever. That was, well, they knew what they were doing back then because Jim Ross was in charge. So, but anyway,
see, and full disclosure, the only thing I really know about wrestling is No Holds Barred, you know, the movie, and Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling. That's like, awesome. That's it for me, really. So,
not to be this guy, but like one of our funniest and earliest episodes of the Film Strip feed is the No Holds Barred review with Brian, our original co-host in that. And I encourage people, if you want to figure out what Film Strip's all about, like that's a good one to start with. So because it's that movie's hilarious and
it just keeps getting more insane. So it's
I mean, more I rewatch it, I'm like, this is just like there's television production murder going on. And at the time that seems so far fetched, but nowadays I'm like, yeah, I can see it, you know.
But speaking of murder.
Nice segue.
Yeah. So Death Wish 3. This was a trip because, you know, the original Death Wish, it's real gritty, it's real grimy. And while this kind of had it, this goes like way over the top, especially at the end with the big, you know, bike gang. I don't know, something about Charles Bronson and that big gun and just, you know, the law rocket launcher and everything. I mean, it's just, it's like everything you wanted as like an 80s kid.
You have that, you have Ed Lauder as the put upon detective, and then you have the gang leader who I only know as the drunk guy, computer programmer, or night security guard from Superman 3.
Superman 3.
That Richard Gere, or Richard Pryor, rather. Not Richard Gere. Richard Pryor convinces him to, you know, turn on the whatever stupid satellite to make fake kryptonite. But I just, when I saw his face, I was like, that can't be the same guy with a reverse mohawk. By George, it was. Also, yeah, didn't know he was Irish. So
I knew him as Eric from Willow.
Oh, see.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Confession, yeah. I've only seen Willow once. And I don't remember anything about it. So.
Oh, wow. Well, the new one's coming out, so it's going to be good, I hope. I used to love Willow. That was like one of my favorites. But yeah. I mean, he's got like this crazy, I mean, he shaves like just the very middle section of his head. I don't know like who thought this was awesome, but they were right.
There's no continuity to the face makeup. It's like three red lines, yeah, a black line down, or three black across and one red down. I'm like, is that how many people you supposedly killed? Like, there were no rules to the gang, and I was confused.
I have no idea.
So they're insane.
Maybe it's like the general, you know, the ranks.
Maybe. But then why was Alex Winter sporting so much of it? So.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Well, that's because he's the one with access to a time machine, so he just went back in time to... I mean, he's the guy who went back in time and shot Abraham Lincoln, I assume.
before he became a vampire, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. This was only a couple of years before his Lost Boyness. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think this was like his actual first role. Like, I think he was still in school and needed some extra cash or something, if I recall. But yeah, it's the craziest thing. The other one, yeah, he takes on punks. He takes on, you know, just various rapists and
Jeff
and
Goldblum.
Thieves. But and Jeff Goldblum in the original, but like here, I mean, it's like a full blown war between, you know, it's like a turf war basically between some older folks and this gang essentially.
It's like a Assault on Precinct 13 almost,
right?
It's like Michael Winter saw that movie and was like, I could do that, but crazier. Yeah, let's shoot this in the worst part of London.
Yeah, but for some reason he had a copy of an early script of Cocoon and decided to marry the two ideas, because you got these geriatric people and then the gang.
I don't know. Yeah. I was ready for a West Side Story style dance off.
Right?
I would have bought it.
Totally. If they turn everything into a Broadway these days, we should do Death Wish 3 the musical. I mean,
I'm on board with it.
Yeah.
$1 million idea right there.
Let's get right on that, Jay.
Hey, I write music. I'm telling you. We can make this happen.
That could work. So Lindsay can write all the dialogue. She's the actor. So yeah.
There you go.
I can try. No promises it'll be any good. But I mean, it'll do justice to the film. How about that?
But you notice there's only two people that are in between the age groups. You have everybody 60 and above, you have everybody like 20 and younger, and then you have the two presumably like 30 and 40 year olds in the public defender and the cop, and like no one else. And it was sort of amazing.
Well Rodriguez, well,
how old do you think Marina Sirtis was when she you know, Deanna Troi, when she was in this? I haven't looked it up, so I have no idea, but I mean, I feel like she was probably in her late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, at least what I figured out. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
But
I feel like someone should look that up.
I mean,
hey, who needs facts?
Clearly no one that made this, because it was just like, I mean, Bronson's like, yeah, I'll do that movie. I'm just going to bring my own gun, though, you know, which I don't know why he sounds like Robert Shaw and Jaws all of a sudden, but you know, whatever. So I don't do a good Bronson, but yeah, I'll leave that to Ron. But yeah,
I don't know if anyone really can do a good Bronson. I mean, Bronson's like his own thing.
Right. So the whole time I'm watching this movie, and every time Martin Balsam shows up, I keep expecting like Mitchell to be sitting outside in a beat up car, like Joe Don Baker, just slouching in there eating a sandwich.
Right. Or I expect him to get on a payphone and tell everybody where he's tracked Marion Crane to. Because he's always Arbogast from Psycho to me. Like, he will always be that guy. When I saw his face, immediately I was like, it's Arbogast. You know, like, forever I will know that guy from that, for the hundreds of roles he played. Sorry. But that's what
he was. I recognized him as a Signor Bianchi from Murder on the Orient Express. That was my first thing. But I'm like a huge Poirot fan. So, I mean, it made sense. But I was like, hey, it's Bianchi, but he's not Italian. So it threw me for a loop at first. I remember the first time I saw it, like, okay, all right, this guy's not Italian, he's a great actor.
There's something very Jewish about all of the residents of the apartment building, and I'm not like criticizing that. I just noticed that. I was like, I don't know if they're saying something, or you know, or if it just happened to work out that way or whatever, but there's like, it was like distinct. You could notice it, except for the younger couple in there, so
right.
who were different, you know.
Yeah, except for the Rodriguez's, if it's a very Jewish building,
right?
I feel like they're making some sort of point about like white flight or something, and these people who don't have any other options being abandoned in this crime-ridden, you know, section of Brooklyn.
Because there is that line where he says, "Anyone who can get out has." So they're all kind of just tied there somehow.
retired, yeah. Living on a fixed income, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Martin so. Balsam's got to be near that taxi meter repair shop he owns.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was his excuse. Yeah. Mm-hmm. he repairs clocks, right? And so he fixes like the meters and stuff for the taxis. I mean, I feel like you can commute for that, right? That seems like something easily. I mean, how often do the meters have to be fixed?
Well, I mean, as the first Death Wish showed us, traveling on the subways in New York is not good. If they didn't, the Warriors
would. That's true. So, yeah. You know,
it's not a safe time to be traveling subterraneously.
So, Jay, are you postulating that's what happened to the Warriors after that movie? They tangled with Bronson and all got gunned down.
I could see it. I mean, or maybe this Paul was Kersey an offshoot. Got him. Some of these guys when they, you know, they, the ones that were more the, like the younger kids in the Warriors took over and they didn't know what they were doing. Like, yeah, this is the Warriors 2 Electric Boogaloo. So
yeah, this is what happened to, what's his name's gang after the Gramercy Riffs drag him off the beach at Coney Island.
Yeah. Yeah. That's yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nobody's coming out and playing anymore. Because now we have this crazy reverse mohawk Irishman running the gang.
Reverse mohawk. That's exactly what it is. It is a reverse mohawk. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Going back to my wrestling, awesome. I know that because Hawk from the Road Warriors had the reverse mohawk. So, and right. The full mohawk. So, yeah.
It's funny because, you know, you've got Gavin O'Hurley being Irish and every extra in this movie is British.
Because they shot in London.
Yeah, they shot it in Brixton.
That's exactly why.
Which Brixton back then was a crime-ridden hellhole, and Brixton now is still kind of a crime-ridden hellhole. And it's basically both the gang violence and rap center of London. You know,
London, not that London was cheaper to shoot in than New York, but that they had not discovered this place called Canada. Which is much closer than London, because every other 80s movie figured out the stand-in for New York is Toronto.
Yeah.
Was Toronto as grimy, though?
It was in Jason Takes Manhattan, so if you watch that. Yeah, that was, 1988, 89? So.
Yeah, it was around there, yeah.
I feel like Toronto would be too expensive for Canon to film in. I feel like they got
for Canon,
sort of
for sure, yeah, yeah.
I feel like they got some sort of sweetheart deal.
Squeeze their budget.
It's like when Charles Band bought that castle. So the next like 8 movies from Full Moon involved the castle somehow. I feel like Golan and Globus owned like a piece of a movie studio in London. And they were just like, we shoot a movie in London. We own building.
I really wish there was a Death Wish 6. Dead Kersey versus the Puppet Master. I kind of need that to have happened. And
I know that there was a script that was they had planned for Death Wish 6, and I guess he just passed. I don't know if it was his health issues or if it was just it was that bad. Because I know starting with like 3, he really had lots of problems with the scripts afterwards.
Yeah, I think I read like he was famously not pleased with this, and I'm like, how did you not know what movie you were making?
Well, the thing is, this is such a big divergence from the first
really
Death Wish movies in tone. This is like a cartoon where people get blown up.
It's the difference
it's basically
in First Blood
Rambo.
And Rambo 2. I mean, it really is. So
Yeah, that's exactly what happened here. And I mean, I know, I guess he and the writer would like just workshop different lines on the set as well. And you can kind of tell. I mean, it has that feeling about it. Like nothing's really set. I mean, there's just like tonally things that are a little off to me and just some of the dialogue in general just doesn't quite jive. I don't know how much of that was just him improvising like specifically or the writer actually coming up with the line because he didn't like the line. But yeah, just it doesn't feel, I mean, it feels unfinished in a lot of ways, you know?
But let's also consider Charles Bronson didn't make the best choices in terms of movie selection. Because this is a guy who famously passed on, you know, Fistful of Dollars. And he also passed on, he passed on that chance to be the Man with No Name. And then he turned down a shot in the sequel. So, like, he's, you know, not the best picker of scripts, I guess. But as long as you cast his wife and, you know, let him use his own gun from home, he's okay.
He's fine, yeah. Yeah, that Wildy is, man, that's something else.
So this is the movie that saved Wildy as a gun manufacturer, because they were literally on their way to going out of business when this movie hit. And apparently every time this movie plays on cable, they get like a surge of buys where people are like, I got to get me this hand cannon.
So now the four of us have all watched this week. So the Wildy guy's sitting around going like, okay, where are the orders coming in? I'm sure you got a report on that. Oh, that's funny. I didn't know that. Yeah. Because that's funny because like Sudden Impact did not save the 44 automatic because you couldn't afford to make the ammo for it, as Beverly Hills Cop 2 and Tony Scott taught us.
I mean, you couldn't afford ammo for anything right now.
Well, true, right? You can't find ammo.
Maybe that's why Bronson's hand loading.
That would make
nothing's
sense.
Too good for these guys.
Nothing's too good. Yeah.
No. Oh man. I mean, I guess we could just go ahead and jump into the plot here. I mean, we've kind of touched on a few things, but we'll just do a quick rundown here. I mean, nutshell version, like I said, Paul Kersey, the vigilante from the first two Death Wishes, returns to New York and tries to save a neighborhood from a gang of thieves. That's the nutshell version. We'll go a little bit deeper here, but so he comes back to visit his buddy, Charlie, I believe. I think they were Korean War buddies, something like that. Yep. And like, as soon as he gets there right before he gets there, actually, Charlie's like beat up by these thugs to the point of death. So that right when Bronson gets there, just, you know, coincidentally, the cops are getting there at the same time and he dies in his arms. They immediately suspect him. And that kind of like sets off the whole thing here. I love that like perfectly convenient plot device. You know, it's like, oh yeah, we just happened to get here right at the same time. Like that never happens ever.
Yeah. They wanted to have an excuse to get Charles Bronson in the cell, like the holding cell with several of the gang members. So that the old man could beat the hell out of these kids and show them some manners. And he absolutely does. Like at one time, I think he actually punches Gavin O'Hurley. It looks like he did.
He does. Yeah. Yeah, he does punch him. Well, there's that whole bit. So, you know, there's the rather large guy that like tries to attack him, and he like grabs him in a headlock essentially, and like shoves his head through the bars. Which,
did you notice,
as a kid, I was like, yes.
That big guy has a hummingbird tattoo on his face.
Right? Did he?
He did. I went back just to make sure I saw it right, and I was just like, what? What gang is that? Yeah. Hummingbird tattoo right on his face. It's a good life.
I wonder if that's his nickname. Cause like they all have crazy nicknames, like the Giggler, you know, and some of the others, there's like Buzzsaw or Hermosa, or something like that.
As Alex Winter, I think. And then
Cuban.
Yeah. Mandy.
The Cuban. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they Cuban. All like have just crazy names. So maybe his is just Hummingbird.
I took their names to be like, for some of them it was more like the descriptor and they just didn't ever come up with a name.
Like the Giggler.
Yeah. Like, what do we call this guy? I don't know. The Giggler.
And he threw me off because every time I saw him, my first thought was that it was it Ozone from
Thank Breaking. You. I thought it was. And it wasn't. When I looked it up, I was like, oh, that would have been so fun if that was.
That would have been awesome.
I can't remember that guy's name, but yeah.
Yeah, he's a choreographer. I don't remember his name either, but that was like my first time. I was like, it's got to be him. Like, man, he's pretty good. He's breaking out of that breakdance mold. No, it's not even him. So I was kind of bummed.
But you know what? That you say this, I didn't realize something though, Jerry, that you say this. The way all these guys are dressed and the way a lot of the fights went down, we kind of joked that it could have been like a dance choreography. I think Michael Winter also watched the Beat It video from Michael Jackson a lot and decided we just need to make that happen. I mean, that's really what a lot of this looks like.
Yeah. I totally see that. Yeah. And there's a lot of the fights. Don't get me wrong. I mean, if you turn your brain off and you just enjoy it for the action, they're awesome. But like a lot of the fights, they look like they're, you know, done at like, I don't know, a theme park. You know, they're that kind of choreographed fights where everybody's going at like maybe 60% of, you know, like let's just do a take at like 60% and then we'll do the real thing later, you know, but like they use the 60% version or something. I don't know, it just, a lot of those fights kind of feel not quite there. And I don't know how much of that was because of Charles Bronson's age or because it was Golan and Globus. Because, you know, sometimes these guys, I mean, I love these guys. They're just fantastic. They have some of the best terrible films I've ever seen in my life.
Right, but then they come out with stuff that like is actually legitimately good, because Ron and I've talked about it. I know y'all talked about it too. Invasion USA is a really, really good movie. Like it actually works. It has a like it's a plot you can buy. Like it's there's something really. I mean, it's got the sleaze to it that you expect, but it's a really well put together thing. And you're like, they made that the same year as this. And it sort of blows your mind that. You know, some things work and some things are like, that could have taken another minute in the oven, you know?
Well, and their budgets were about the same, weren't they? They were both about 10 million-ish, something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And didn't Bronson get like 2 million of it or something?
So, yeah, he got something like 1.5 or 2, something like that. I mean, that's awesome. Like, good for him, you know, especially at 60, whatever, 63, 64. Yeah, good for him. Get your money, man.
They made him look really good, though. They made him look tough. He looked tough through the whole movie. And somehow managed to appear to be 80 years old and 12 years old at the same time. I don't know how those physics work, but...
He's Ghost of Christmas Pasting it.
Yes.
Yeah. You imagine Charles Bronson in a Christmas carol all of a sudden.
But he has like a weird baby face thing going on.
He does.
On.
It's the shape of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That haircut's not doing him any favors either.
It's and not.
That,
it's
that
not.
That porn stash that's held on for so long, too, that he had. So. The Kerwin Bell, I call that for you Southern football fans that grew up watching Florida. But yeah. So Ron knows what I'm talking about. But yeah.
I do. So,
yeah. So.
Yeah, I mean, really, yeah, you're like right.
It's funny to watch him, but you're right, Lindsay, because he looks like he has a couple of scenes where his shirt's off, and I'm like, you know, for a 64-year-old man, he's in pretty darn good shape. Like I'm two thirds of that age. I wish I looked that good. Good grief. So he's in shape. So
look at the Undertaker like his, can still do it.
I mean, true.
Good call. Speaking Lindsay. Of Ric Flair. Isn't he returning? Yeah.
Sadly. Yeah.
But. Just imagine how much of a beast Charles Bronson would be if he had access to modern steroids.
Right.
If you get
or Charles like just Bronson the workout regimes that like more modern actors go through, you know.
Yeah, if Charles Bronson had a training regimen that wasn't just cigarettes, just a monster.
Cigarettes and like mounds of bacon. I feel like was his breakfast.
That's what I imagine. Black, yeah.
Jet black. Oil
bacon
coffee.
Sandwich,
right?
Oh man, with mayonnaise,
right? I'm getting a lot of fried mayonnaise, oh, no. Bacon sandwich while I reload my gun. So, yeah, on the set, yeah,
I gotta make some bullets for my Wild E. Yeah. I can't do Bronson. I'm sorry.
I think the funniest story I read about him is that he's like they had a trouble shooting the part where he's supposed to hit Alex Winter with a because he's going after the Rodriguez wife in the car.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And he's hanging off the roof and Bronson hits him with a tire iron and they couldn't get him to do it because Bronson's like, if I hit this kid looks like a choir boy. If I hit him, I'll lose my audience. And they finally convinced him to do it. And Alex Winter was like, I was dressed in like this ridiculous garb. I was like, what kind of choirs have you been hanging around, man?
Choirs are different in coal country, Jay.
True. Fair.
Yeah. So Charles Bronson, I actually like a lot of his outfits in this. Like they dress him in like that leather jacket, but he's kind of got like the turtleneck kind of thing, or like a, I don't know, mock neck or whatever they're called. But he looks pretty darn slick. And so I get what you mean about like even though he's 60 or whatever, he actually looks younger than he is. And I guess that's why they paired him with, you know, that lady, I don't even remember her name now, the DA that's like 30 years his junior.
Yeah, Catherine Davis is the character's name. So,
Miss Davis. Yeah, because he says like Miss Davis like a million times. Yeah.
Well, and in real life, Deborah Raffin was friends with his wife.
So, yeah.
So is it really that crazy for him to be dating someone 30 years younger than him? When he's married to someone 30 years younger than him in real life.
Yeah, that's true. No. Yeah, good point.
Fair.
Kind of wonder if that was a stipulation of the scripting, too. It's like, yeah, I got my neighbor here. She's pretty good. So put her in this thing. So,
but I wonder if that's why, like, their kisses, like, whenever they kissed, it was like so chased and like there was no like heat or passion or anything, you know, like they're supposed to be like attracted to each other. And I mean, you know, they sleep together, but it's like they kiss and it's like the most benign thing ever. Like, okay, well, yeah,
but to be
maybe
fair,
that's why, he doesn't, it's like his wife's friend.
Well, to be fair, in Death Wish 2, he's kissing his actual wife and they don't have any chemistry on screen either. So
I think Bronson was a romantic lead. I don't think that ever really would have worked, you know, but like, I'll tell you an 80s movie that has like the age difference between your male and female lead that works is Robert Forrester and Robin Riker in Alligator. The original Alligator, because he's a good bit older than her, like maybe 20 years in that movie. But it works because they have a ton of chemistry together and they're like, their love scenes, there's nothing to it at all. They're just laying in bed. But you like feel like there's chemistry there. Whereas I'm watching this and I'm like, this looks so awkward and strange for everybody
it really does,
here.
Yeah.
The three of us have reviewed some awkward love scenes, as we like to say, Silent Night, Deadly Night 5.
Some might call them gross.
Yes, that would be a word. Gross. And awkward, I don't know where this ranked on the grossometer. It wasn't that bad, but there was also like nothing, like no heat.
That's what I mean. Like it was just, it was so chaste and it felt kind of weird in like this movie. Like, I don't know, like it didn't belong in this particular movie just with how gritty and violent and, you know, just how over the top everything was. And then they're just, you know, little pecks. I mean, it was weird.
Yeah, so, I will say, though, the chasteness also translated to her dying. A, I didn't feel terrible when she ended up getting blown up. And B, I don't think Charles Bronson did either, because he didn't do anything. He just kind of shrugged his shoulders and turned around and walked away. Right? I mean, he ran toward the car for a second, and then he was like, well, his back.
I love how like the car just ran into another car and then like just blew up. Like, just like, I've never seen, I mean, God willing, I never do, but I mean, I've never seen that happen. Usually they just kind of collide and that's about it.
So I recently rewatched an episode of Hunter on Peacock right now, if you guys don't remember that one from the 80s.
Yeah.
And I do encourage you to all go seek it out. And it's there's
Christmas episode.
I don't remember the particular episode I was watching. It may have been The Shooter. I can't remember. It was in the first season. But his co-star, his detective friend, his co-detective, Hunter, takes this huge shotgun, leans out of his car, and shoots the truck bed, the tailgate of the back of a truck. And it launches that truck 12 feet into the air into a fiery explosion, lands down, to which the driver of the truck walks away because this was on NBC. And I was like, I miss the 80s when every car was assumed to be a Ford Pinto and just put explode.
Just blew up.
Yes, it was very G.I. Joe. It was so fun because I was like, oh, this is my wife walks in and sees this at the time. And she was like, oh, that's ridiculous. I was like, yes, but this was the 80s. This is what we did, you know? And she had never seen it. So I was like, oh, you got to watch this show. It's like the proto all the cop shows. And I love that show. It still works.
Hunter.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the Dirty Harry for network television, because Fred Dreyer he's kind of tall, Clint Eastwood, ex-football player guy. He's actually a decent actor, and it works kind of like Dirty Harry, except he actually does actual police work sometimes.
Do you think Charles Bronson worked as a kind of Dirty Harry?
No. Charles Bronson is, this is what I was supposed to be in those Man with No Name things that Clint did, and I'm just going to do it in the streets. So that's what he was doing, I think. So.
You're paying me how much? All right,
I'll say the lines. All right, let's do it.
We got to talk about it.
You put my wife in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, this moment though, like, what happens is he's in jail, and the cop is trying to keep him there because he knows like who he is.
I know you, Kersey. It's Paul Kersey. You see, I was with the New York PD the night they brought a vigilante in with a bullet in his leg. Maybe I should have you killed. You always violate people's constitutional rights. I'm the law. That means I get to violate your constitutional rights.
And the assistant DA lady is the one that's like, you really have to let this person go. You can't just keep them for no reason. And then the cop's answer is, well, we're just going to turn you loose on the gang.
You letting me loose? The way he said that. It's like, what?
Yep.
But yeah. So, Schreiker, I guess is the name. There's like a lot of names that end in ER, Schreiker, Fraker. So for a while there, I was getting them mixed up. But yeah, so Schreiker is Ed Lautner's character. And yeah, he recognizes him as like the vigilante. He figures he went pro because of all the stuff that happened in LA. Somehow they heard about it in New York. And so he goes to let him loose on the condition that every once in a while they'll give him info and let him make a bust. But it's like, come on, you know who this guy is. You've heard all about him. Do you really think he's going to just let people live so you can make a bust? Or like,
I can actually weigh in on this, though, because in my hometown, Jerry, we had a chief of police who made a deal with one drug gang to rat out the other one. So they got to operate in one neighborhood so he could constantly bust the other ones. And the only reason he ever lost his job is because the moron, high on cocaine, by the way, fired his gun in the middle of a neighborhood and they had to let him go. So, yeah. And that's okay. North Alabama. So, yes, I could believe that in the 1980s, right, a New York City cop would make a dirty deal like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, all right. Okay. Well, I mean, I just like, I'm more like, how does he expect any kind of bust from this? You know, like how does he know Bronson will let anybody live? I guess that's my problem with him. You know, but he like lets him loose essentially to go run this whole war, and it's great. I love it because I mean it turns from like just you know getting a car like buying an old car and using that as bait, which by the way is from the actual book, but using that as bait just to kill some guys and send a message, all the way to like Fraker, the main bad guy, you know, the reverse Mohawk guy, calling, I don't know, 1-800, like dial a thug or something. Like, who does he call to get extra guys? I don't understand, you know, but you know, like him calling extra guys so that he can have like just a complete raid on Charles Bronson.
I took it as like he had pockets of that gang in the other boroughs. And what he had done in the post Warriors days was consolidate all the gangs. And so he just had like, you know, branches and he could call in reinforcements. That's the way I took that. Cause again, I was very much going down. I was legitimizing this movie more than it deserves by connecting it to that Walter Hill classic, but I mean, it made sense in my head. So.
Okay. Well, that actually checks out to me. I could deal with that. But I love it because like, as you know, he's preparing all this stuff, you know, people's houses keep breaking in, getting broken into. And so he creates like all these booby traps. He's got the board that like, you know, so when someone opens a window, it'll like slap him in the face. And of course it works. And some people's teeth are there, which was like super awesome. But then he's got like the nails on the floor. I mean, just all sorts of cool little booby traps that I thought, man, this guy, like this is where Kevin McAllister got like all his ideas from, you know, like this is where he would turn
next level Home Alone booby trapping.
Yeah. I could totally see him doing this. Like nowadays, like, you know, there's that whole bit about him, like, during the purge, if he would win, you know, survive or whatever, like I could totally see him doing that, like on purge night.
if he was had been still alive, he would have had the Michael T. Williamson role in that purge movie he was in. I'm convinced of it. So he would have been
in that movie. I could see that. Yeah,
nothing against Michael T. I love him, but you know this. That yeah, Charles would have been on that roof. Like I could see that.
Well, so we get Rodriguez, who's like that young Hispanic couple that lives in the building. The wife is kidnapped and raped, and in a deleted scene, I guess her arm was actually broken, which is why later on, you know, the doctor says, well, you know, her arm was broken, but somehow it threw a clot. And so she died, you know, but she passes away and the husband's completely distraught. This is where we get like our Christmas moment where as they're on the phone, surrounding like all their statues of the Blessed Virgin and Jesus and everything, there's like Christmas lights hung around. So that's enough for me to count it.
See, I was wondering, I was like, okay, how is this? Because I did not remember this. And then I saw that scene. I was like, oh, that's what there is. The back. There it is. There's Jerry's head. So I wonder.
And the Keprovs also have their menorah out.
I think they have a menorah in there too. Yeah.
They do. Yeah. You see it when they their apartment first gets broken into. Earlier in the movie.
Is which, that after okay, the cop so, makes him give up the gun and then like the next day?
That's what I was going to bring up. Like, was that really a thing? Was there like, were guns really illegal to own
in, kind of,
in New York at that time?
I, yeah. Yeah, I got a whole history lesson from my dad on this actually today.
Oh, okay.
When
nice.
I was talking about it. So the Sullivan Act was actually a thing in the state of New York, which was made law in 1911. And basically it's a, you may purchase a gun, not you can purchase a gun. So you have to get special permissions to do it. And in New York City, it was really strict because the police force is who gave the permissions for someone to purchase a gun, but it was super corrupt. And a lot of the corruption was led by the Irish mafia and the politicians in New York at the time. So interesting that our head gang leader is also Irish. But yeah, I think, I don't know, actually, I didn't look to see if the Sullivan Act is still a thing, but that is where it came from. Cause that was, I Googled that immediately. I was like, is that a real thing? I didn't, but yeah, it was, it was. It was a real thing.
Wow. I mean, that's just crazy to me. But I'm from Texas, so I mean, you know, everybody's yeah. been here. So yeah. I
hand them out at the Dunkin' Donuts.
So. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's a part of the combo meal, you know.
Right. But I mean, really, though, but that was like, I saw that and all I could think of was like, so did somebody tip the gang off or did they just see the cops leave and they're like, well, obviously they just disarmed the old Jewish couple. So we're just going to come in every night and take what we want, you know? And I was like, oh man, this is.
My impression was that they called the cops on the Jewish couple.
Oh, good call.
Because the cops were corrupt.
The cops
say.
Because
even without all the guns, like homicide rates and crime was still like way, way high. And clearly the cops weren't doing anything about it. And there's a line earlier in the movie where they say the only thing the cops do is enforce the parking laws. So it kind of gives the impression that the cops are dirty in that area.
I feel like, you know, Lindsay talked about the Irish mob and we know that Fraker is Irish. I feel like this ties all to Death Wish 5,
yeah.
Charles Bronson fights the Irish mob, and there's also fashion involved.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. There's like
that
a
sounds
whole,
delightful.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like a shootout in like a backstage area or something like a dressing,
something like that. Yeah,
dry
yeah.
cleaners.
It's been a while
something.
Since I've
lots
seen
lots of
five. Yeah.
Shot mannequins, I believe.
Yes, yes. So I remember that. I remember that detail though, Ron. That's wow. What a tie-in. So, holy cow. I mean, you got to connect it all by a thread somehow, right? Because at this point, this is the loosest of threads that they're letting this work. So I did appreciate though that they did at least like recognize that he walks back into town in a city as large as New York, and the first cop that sees him is like, "Oh no, bad news! No, no, no!" Like these that notorious 10, 15 years later, like, "Yeah, we remember you." You know, it's like when Michael Myers comes back to Haddonfield or Loomis walks in the, yeah, when Loomis crosses the line, like, no, you go away. So,
I mean, if you saw a man who looked like a chainsaw carving come to life, I think you'd remember him the next time you saw him.
That is true.
He is, probably would recognize him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so, okay. We get quite a few things here and there. He's defending it. He meets that DA. She, I don't know how, I don't remember how she says she finds him, but she finds him. He asks her to dinner and they have like their own little thing. And later on we get Fraker actually following him because, you know, and he sees that he's with her. So then we get that scene that you were talking about, Lindsay, earlier, where he kills her essentially, she like just lets the car, I guess, in neutral and it just kind of drives off and explodes randomly. But that kind of follows Kersey having like a shootout as well at nighttime, you know, where like the gang, he kind of takes on the gang and he loses his gun for a bit. And that's when like they sick the Cuban on him, but he throws him off the building. I mean, there's like a whole little mini war before like the big gang war at the very end. but I kind of really enjoyed it. I mean, it was, I was, you know, it was suspenseful, I think. This is the first time you saw it, Lindsay's. What do you think? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go, go.
I really liked it. I was really surprised at how much I liked it. I just really settled in. It was super entertaining. I can't really explain why. I think because it was so over the top that I was never really worried about any person because I didn't really ever fully let myself go and believe that these were real people. They were always just actors playing this role, I think. Right. But it was right. It was just super easy to settle into and enjoy the movie. And all of the fight scenes where the creeps are getting shot or taken down or hit in the face with boards or whatever, my favorite part was this sweet little old Jewish couple and just the pure joy on their face at watching the creeps get like shot and beat and like just watching the whole thing unfold and just how joyful they were. And that made the whole movie for me.
Well, that's like, okay. So when Giggler steals that lady's purse or steals his camera and he like shoots him in the back. And then like that lady comes out and she's like, he stole my purse like 3 weeks ago. Like I'm like, he's dead. I'm glad he's dead. And
yeah, it's
that kind of thing. Yeah. Everybody's into it. Like they're like, yeah, kill these guys.
They killed the Giggler, man. They killed the Giggler!
We need you. It's about time. I'm glad he's dead. He took my purse 3 weeks ago. He should have been dead. I'm glad he's dead.
Christ, there's not much left of this sucker, is there?
Yeah, they're just ready to go.
Only topped by the cheering Jewish couple to me was when he's showing them the Wally, and he's loading it for them. Like the old people are sitting around like it's bingo going, ooh, ah, like they're like getting charged up while he's loading up the guns. And I'm like, this is like, he pulls out the rocket and all this stuff. I'm like, this is hilarious. They're like, he's our Terminator, y'all. Like, like they've hired their own little hitman. And there was just something incredibly charming about the idea of thinking like, you know, old Westerns and even, you know, more contemporary Westerns, there's a plot line of like the town finally has enough and the townspeople just band together and they pull together their money and they hire the gunslinger. Right. And I felt like this movie is sort of built around the same trope. They didn't really hire him. He came in because his friend got killed, but they take care of him real quick and they cook him food. And they're like, okay, are you all right? You happy? And like, they're like, if we're nice to him, maybe he'll shoot all the people that are terrorizing us. And by George, he's like, well, I was going to shoot him anyway, but I'll do it just for y'all. You know? And I mean, yeah, it's hilarious to watch all that. I mean, it's fun. And you don't want to condone it, but again, this is a friggin' cartoon, so it's, I mean,
yeah,
it's,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a G.I. Joe episode, basically,
yeah,
except
yeah,
people die,
yeah, it's ridiculous. And it's, I mean, there's some over the top squib action going on in this movie, too. I was sort of impressed.
There's a lot,
like,
yeah,
it's like, wow, there's where the budget went outside of Bronson, like it was on all of the special effects and good practical effects and all the explosions and thermite,
which there's a lot of
lighting off, yeah.
Like there's the biker gang like driving around with like Molotov cocktails, you know. I mean, there was a lot of. I mean, they burned down his taxi repair shop.
One of them definitely had a grenade. Just a straight up grenade. I don't know where they would have acquired such a thing.
But Irish they did. Mob.
Probably left over from World War II, the Blitz. I guess I don't know.
Could be.
I assume they just found a lot of random explosives lying around London after the, you know,
we got two old people with 30mm machine guns and ammo bags in a closet.
Charlie.
Like just hanging on to it. Like that might come in useful one day. I mean,
I love how the gun like jams, you know, like he's finally, Bennett's finally had enough. He's like, all right, I'm going to take these guys out. And it like just jams on him. It's like, okay, well, that sucks. Like, oh, run, man. Don't just stand there and well, they get him.
To Martin Balsam's stunt double for that dive off the West Side Story scaffolding or whatever that he had going in the background. I was like, oh, that's clearly not him. But then the little trickle of blood down his face, I'm like, oh, that's so quaint that they tried to make him the old man bleed. I thought he was dead, though. When he shows up alive.
I thought he was, too.
Yeah, I thought he was dead, too. Yeah. Yeah, they kind of.
I'm glad. And
I think the only reason they kept him alive was that so he could tell him where that other machine gun was.
Yeah.
That's right. Really.
Don't worry, I still have the other one, or something like that, right? Yeah. Isn't that what he said?
That's a great line. Yeah. And then when the cop comes in the hospital room, he's like, "Oh, he had to go." Of course.
So they actually take Kersey back in to like protect him because they feel like, okay, well, I mean, you're in too deep now or something. I don't know. And so they like take him back. They're going to put him in custody, protective custody. And he escapes essentially. And they're like, well, what are you going to do? Like they don't try to look after him. They're just like, all right, well, I guess that's it.
So although, I invented a theory as to why there's no like newspaper coverage of what's going on in this neighborhood. Follow me along here. This is the same time frame as Brewster's Millions is happening in Manhattan. So everybody is following Brewster's Millions and they're not paying attention to the gang war happening in Lower Brooklyn. I mean, they look like they're shot in the same stock of film. I argue that's where the press was, is they were all enamored with this man blowing $30 million in a month instead of this old man blowing people away in the streets.
I mean, do you want a feel good story or do you want like street crime? Because, you know, the New York Post can only come up with so many puns about people murdered with, you know, hand cannons.
I mean, I think what would have been great is when the gang is having the meeting, if somebody had had a quote of like, "They killed the giggler, man." Like, we're supposed to know who the hell that even is. You know, like, oh, that's what they call that dude? I was like, I got a laugh out of that because that guy was indignant about that. I was like, that dude, that was just one scene and he was going to chew the heck out of it.
I may or may not be doing that later.
But I mean, really, it's a great moment because I did cackle at that moment.
Yeah, I did like, too. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when the cartoon is self-aware enough to be that level, I mean, it's as funny as when Chuck Norris drops the bomb that was supposed to be the Church of Invasion USA back on the, you know, invaders. Is like, oh, it didn't work before. Works now, you know. That deadpan humor is
which is funny because they offered this movie to Chuck Norris when Charles Bronson didn't want to do it, but Chuck Norris was like, "No, that movie is way too negative for me." I assume because I don't know, he probably just didn't want to go to London,
and so Charles Bronson was like, "All it was, yeah,
I'll do it for a bag of cash."
Yeah.
How much are you going to pay him? Are you going to pay me that? No? I'm out.
I think they ended up paying Charles Bronson more than they would have paid Chuck Norris for this.
Oh, I'm sure they did. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. That dude is raking it in from Canon, which is not something you normally say. I mean, Canon notorious for like some of their money, you know, tightness.
I want to know what movie was a big enough hit that funded this for them. Because you know the stories are like, we all know the story of like why Superman 4 is one of the reasons it's so lousy is because Life Force destroyed its budget in the fact that it didn't work and they sunk so much money into it. So I want to know what movie had been such a hit in 83 or 84. Rhonda, you know that would have funded a $10 million Death Wish 3. Would have been one of the Breaking movies?
It might have been Breaking.
Doubt it. You think so?
Breaking was a huge hit. The first one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember. My brother was a huge
it definitely Breaking. Wasn't Ninja 3.
Hey man, that VA
I love series. Ninja 3. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying it wasn't a hit.
Lindsay, speaking of interesting or potentially gross sex scenes, just check that out on YouTube sometime with the V8.
V8.
Yeah, never look at that again.
Where's the lead in going, Jay? Where's that going?
I got you there. There's a sword involved. I mean, it's
all amazing. Right. So, if I had to guess, Jay, the big hit that funded this one was probably Missing in Action.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because that was 84.
Yeah.
And they would have gotten the money for that to put this together, or possibly, probably not Invasion USA because that came out in 85. That's a little too close.
Mm-hmm. But, right. Missing that, I agree. Yeah, that was a major hit. You're right. So yeah, that would have given the money to do this because we know that's how Golden Globes work. It was just one thing to the next. So
it might have been Enter the Ninja and Revenge of the Ninja. Both those came out before.
Yeah, both of the quality flicks. By the way, I would recommend Revenge of the Ninja just as a straight up like I still have, I watched the DVD not that long ago. Ron introduced that to me. Nice. So that was, yeah, it was a good, that's a legit recommendation. You should check that one out. That's a fun movie.
Yeah.
So,
man, I haven't seen those in a long time.
It's like, I feel like I've seen that one, but all memory of it escapes me. So yeah. Worth a rewatch.
Shokasugi for the win. So, oh, that would have been what would have tied this movie together. If Bronson said, I'm going to call in a little reinforcement, and showed up with the sword and started chopping these dudes down.
I'll tell you what, though. Yeah. I'm in. Let's do this. Yeah.
I mean, while he's gunning them down in the street, someone, you know,
someone cut him in there.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
That would have been awesome. Yeah. So, long story short, big war at the end, and Charles Bronson wins with help from Schreiker, who happens to shoot or distract, I guess it was probably better, Fraker, and give Charles Bronson enough time to hit him with the rocket launcher, which as soon as like his gang sees like his burning corpse.
Yeah, this is this lump of, you know, flesh.
I mean, I guess they knew he was going in.
But this is two movies in 1985 from Golden Globus where somebody gets whacked by a rocket launcher at the end of it. Invasion USA also ends on the same note. And as we talked about, and y'all talked about when you reviewed it, like it disintegrates that person. So Manny Frank, really, at least, I guess, had enough alcohol or drugs in him to keep burning on the ground. So, because Rostov just turned into dust. Because secretly he was a vampire that could walk in the day. That was my theory.
Well, and don't they use like a big rocket launcher in Hard Ticket to Hawaii as well? Like, don't they finally kill the snake with the rocket launcher?
Yeah, the big radioactive snake.
Something. Yeah, yeah. It's like something about killing people with rocket launchers in this time era. That it was the thing you did.
How did you just tie Golan and Globus with Jim Wynorski? That's incredible, right? Jerry.
That's great. Yeah.
I randomly have a talent here too.
I think the fascination with the Law Rocket in action movies can all be pinpointed back to the Enforcer when Dirty Harry picked one up and shot the guy that shot Tom Daly. And because I mean they set that up early in that movie, and it's like, oh yeah. And so then rewatched that when Ron did that series years ago, I realized that, like, oh, the Law Rocket showed up in a lot of 80s movies, and I think it's because they saw that and everybody's like, well, if it's good enough for Clint, you know, so you just put it in every.
But before thing. We go on, I have to correct myself. It wasn't Jim Wynorski, it was Andy Sedaris. They're basically the same guy.
Yeah.
But internet, leave me alone. I'm sorry.
Tomato, tomato. So,
I don't think my listeners will care.
I'm still impressed that we made that connection, though. That's impressive. So,
it's like the first thing I thought of when someone shot someone with a rocket launcher. It's like, oh yeah, the snake.
Can we talk about how Stryker gets shot in the arm, like the traditional 80s flesh wound thing? And if you go watch The Asphalt Jungle, that's pretty much what Sterling Hayden dies from. And I'm like, wow, we came a long way in 30 years of movie making. Maybe it's the dramatic.
Say like, oh, it's just a scratch or something like that.
Yeah, it's like, it's just a nick. Call the hospital, you know, in his exasperated voice. But I mean, I kept wondering. I was like, wait a minute, he loaded that rocket and stuck it behind that table, like,
yeah, it's like gotta Chekhov's come back law.
Yeah, like, we gotta have that Chekhov's come back launcher. And when homeboy jumped up with the bulletproof vest, I was like, oh, of course he would have that. You know, and
just like you.
Yeah. Also, now I know Joel Schumacher figured out the ending of Batman Forever from this, because you can't choose us both. Well, yeah, I can, you know. So when I'm Batman or I have a rocket launcher. So there you go. I just out Joe Schumacher to this. There you go.
I think you
Alex Winter was involved. It's all connected, y'all.
I feel like this is a new version of the Kevin Bacon game.
But who are we connected? The rocket launcher or
well, okay. Yeah.
6 degrees of rocket launcher.
So we connected the scenario to Joel Schumacher, who's also connected to Alex Winter from The Lost Boys. So,
mm-hmm. Oh, that's, we did mention that. Yeah.
7 years after The Lost Boys is when he did Batman Forever. So, with a good old Val and Nicole. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was like 94, something like that.
95, somewhere 95, along there. Yeah,
yeah, around there. Yeah,
somewhere along. So same era. So, but yeah. So anyway, but yeah, but no, I knew the Rocket was coming back. I was like, that has to come back at some point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially for a canon film, you know that they got to use the rocket launcher somehow.
Anybody feel bad for the people though? Like they got their neighborhood back, but the building is completely destroyed.
But at what cost?
Yeah. They were so happy and excited and jumping for joy though. I feel like, I don't know. In that moment, I was like, oh, yeah, they all seem spry enough to rebuild it themselves. That'll work.
Definition
it's,
of a pure.
It's still
victory.
A win. Yeah.
Now, my question is, how did Rodriguez survive that final fight just with a little zip gun?
With the little zip gun, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that was impressive.
I don't know.
I figured he was dead meat from the beginning. I figured he would have to die too.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kersey would be like, it's the Puerto Rican son I never wanted.
He does make him carry his ammo around when he's firing that 30 cal.
Yeah, he does.
Gunning these people down. But it's about hilarious. Like he's just shooting at all these people. Like clearly two scenes shot at different times. So Charles is going to fire the gun a lot. And then, okay, everybody act like you get shot. And that means jump backwards 12 feet. So, but you know, it was the 80s where bullets did that too. I love that.
Well, and there was a lot of like that typical, you know, action, especially in the 80s, that action flick where the guy just kind of is out in the open just shooting everybody and no one can hit him and he's out in the open. Like, come on guys. Like yeah. Just be better shots. I mean, I guess they're all coked up, so I guess it really doesn't matter, but
are there stormtroopers? You know, or Cobra from G.I. Joe. They couldn't hit Jackie.
So, Cobra couldn't hit anything either, yeah.
Yeah. To be fair, neither could G.I. Joe. So
well, that's true. Straight, well, you said straight. Cobra, my first thought was Stallone.
Yeah, could we have had the Night Slasher make an appearance, you like roll through, like, no, these people are too much for me, I'm going back to the West Coast.
But you know, it does make me wonder, what would you guys say would be your happiest memory or moment with this film here, or film series if you'd like?
It was the old people celebrating the Wally coming in. Like that was hilarious. Like they were all opening up a Christmas present together. You know?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Mine was definitely the old couple giggling at seeing two teeth lodged in that board booby trap that they had at their window.
They were so excited to see the teeth there.
They were giddy, purely pure giddiness.
Mine would be the fact that when Martin Balsam gets out that belt-fed machine gun, he's cradling it like a baby.
Yes.
It's a special thing, man. I think for me, the best part was just that rocket launcher, man, and just how they blew him up, and right away, like, his girlfriend knows that it's him. You know, it could have been anybody, really, but no, she knows that it's him, and they all just kind of back away, and everybody cheers. It's amazing.
I don't know if you noticed this, Jerry, but the girlfriend was the female Cenobite from Hellraiser 3? Hellraiser 2?
Yeah.
Was she really? No, I didn't notice that at all.
Mm-hmm. That's her. Wow. Barbie Wilde.
Wow.
Well, now Hellraiser I got to go back 3. And watch that.
That's, yeah, boy, there's a trip into strange land real quick.
But not D. Snyder's strange land.
Talk about like going from a part one and two that have like a theme, and then Hellraiser 3 is a sharp right turn in Albuquerque, much like this series. So
I mean, I guess that's kind of also typical for the 80s, because I mean, you think about like Halloween, you know, 1 and 2, and then Halloween 3, same thing, was just like, well,
Halloween 3 is the idea of, let's do this in an anthology series and pick the worst possible story to launch that idea from. I mean, it's fun. Like it is.
I was going to say, as bad as it is, I kind of still like it.
Oh, it is. It's just in Halloween, it's just the weirdest like moment and stuff. But no, that's a hilarious rewatch. Anytime you can get it. So yeah.
But I do have a question for y'all. So if you could actually like be a character or like be in this film, who would you be?
I mean, I would clearly be one of the guys who showed up with the motorcycle gang. Cause I mean, my face.
Yeah, I got to.
My face and my badly dubbed New York accent.
There you go. I think I would be one of the cops doing the investigation on the giggler scene. Like, look at the hole in this guy. Like, I'm just being sort of amazed. They're like, what could do that? You know, like that would be me, or just one of the put upon shop owners that my stuff was getting broken into all the time. Probably.
Yeah. I think probably, I'd be the little old Jewish lady. Just like clapping my hands.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I'd probably be like the little boy that he buys like the ice cream for. That probably is who I'd be. But I think it'd be fun to like play one of the gang members, honestly. Like just go all out, go crazy. I don't think I could pull it off, but I think it'd be fun to try.
I don't know, Jerry. Man, get some paint smeared on your forehead.
I'll try it with the lines. Yeah. The question is, do I do two or three? I don't know.
Depends on your rank, I think, is what we've decided.
That's what we decided on, yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. But now we come to my favorite part of the show, which is a little segment I like to call Gag Me With a Spoon. So this is where we do our best impression of our least favorite part of the movie here. So as the guests, I'll let you go first. Just kind of set up the scene a little bit for us and then, you know, go for it.
So imagine an interior, dark lights, a couple laying in bed. And the female says, "I made chicken. I hope you like it. It's the only thing I know how to make." And the old man says, "Chicken's good. I like chicken." End scene.
No, they weren't in bed yet. That comes later.
Yeah, it's all the precursor to the bed. It's just that was as flat as it came on. That's
bad. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, you could tell they were like friends or something, or like he didn't want to even try because that was his wife's friend. Yeah.
But Jay, we're not going to leave that scene yet because that's where my moment comes from, which is he comes to the door, he gives her a bottle of wine, and he says, "Good, the shop says this is good wine. Well, let's open it." I like opera.
I love how she questions that later too. "Do you really like opera?" "No."
Yeah.
He's almost as like monotone as Chuck Norris in Invasion USA.
Almost.
Almost. Just a little more. A little. Oh man. What about you, Lindsay?
Oh man. All right. I can't decide. I have two. I'm just going to go with the first one here.
Okay.
Imagine a bunch of ruffians sitting around a circle mourning the death of one of their recently demised cohorts. They killed the giggler. They had no business doing that. None.
That's actually awesome. The one I was going to use. All
right, I'm so sorry. I took it.
No worries. That's,
I can do a different one if you want to cut it out.
No worries. That was great. That was great. I'll do something else. All right. So this is about his delivery. Okay. Right here. So this is where his wildie has come in and he's you know, loading the shells himself. And so Bennett's like, "You load the shells yourself?" And so Paul Kersey, in his typical flat way, goes, "Nothing's too good for our friends." It's like, come on, man. That was better lines than that. All right. Wow. That was my best. Not quite as good as yours, but but it does make me wonder, you know, G.I. Joe, they taught us that knowing is half the battle. What do you think the other half is?
I got this. This is all a conspiracy of Ed Koch, who was the mayor of New York at the time, or Heller and whoever are in Brewster's Millions, if we go with that theory, those losers that Brewster tried to run against with none of the above. It's all a conspiracy of them and city infrastructure and waste management to do some kind of gentrification effort in the area. So they're just going to let it get leveled and then rebuild on top of it. I think they're letting it go so they can come in and Trump build on top of it again. That's my theory. That's the other half of the story.
Okay. All right. What do you think, Ron?
Well, the other half of the battle to me is not touching Charles Bronson's car.
That's good. Yeah. That's true. Oh, man. Lindsay?
I'd have to say target practice.
Ooh, I like that one. So I actually have two, but I think I'm going to use the first one here. So if no one's half the battle, the other half is collection time.
Nice.
It's collection time, Charlie. Collection time.
Oh, man. Guys, it's been so much fun talking with you. But, you know, tell me about your show. Like, what do you want to plug?
Film Strip Pod, where we review pretty much whatever movies we feel like reviewing. There's no rhyme or reason or pattern to any of the movies we review. Some of them are great, some of them not so great. But you can find us on Film Strip Podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Right on. And social media?
Social media, we're on Instagram and Twitter, and also Film Strip Podcast.
Cool. Right on. Definitely check it out. Some amazing stuff. Your rare exports episode is is really great. One of my favorites. I happened to make a little appearance there talking Gremlins this past Christmas. Yep. So definitely check that one out. That was a lot of fun as well. One more time, I got to say thank you. This was a lot of fun just connecting the dots, man. It's all connected. And now I feel like that Charlie Day meme, you know, just...
Yeah. with that pretty well describes how our show generally goes too. So no matter who's on it. So 300 plus episodes and almost 12 years later, we're still doing that. So yeah.
Michael, all fun. Michael Winner is Pepe Silvia.
There we go. Thanks, Jared. And
on that blast, note, man. On that note, I'm gonna end it by saying I'm going out for some ice cream. This is America, isn't it? So check us out on our social media pages, Facebook and Instagram at Totally Rad Christmas, Twitter at Rad Christmas, or our Facebook group, Totally Rad Christmas Mall and Arcade, where you can make your voice known to us as well. We post anything and everything 80s or Christmas related. And if you're feeling like Charles Bronson getting 15% of the budget as salary, leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us reach more people and spread some rad holiday cheer. Now don't forget to check out our merch shop on tpublic.com and our super dope website, totallyradchristmas.com, courtesy of Tis the Podcast Elf, Tom Crow. Merry Christmas to all, and to all a safe night. Later, dudes.
The Christmas Alphabet Podcast is all about Christmas in alphabetical order. I'm Wayne, your host, and I bring you a new episode every 2 weeks throughout the year. Each time we look at Christmas history, food, music, and fun facts, starting with just one letter of the alphabet. Join me as we follow the alphabet all through the year, all about Christmas. Subscribe and join us at the Christmas Alphabet Podcast.